Ladies and gentlemen, good afternoon. Thank you for being here in room 8. Our next session is about to start. So would you please welcome Hans Verbeek and Kurt Kleijs.
Thank you. Thank you very much and welcome. I hope you enjoyed the session so far. I believe that many of you were in Anders' session about C Sharp 4, so that's definitely an interesting talk. This talk is going to be about ORM, and ORM is Object Relational Mapping, and more specifically about ORM with ADO.NET Entity Framework in .NET 4, so it's the version 2 of the Entity Framework. My name is Hans Verbeek, I'm a Developer Evangelism Manager at Microsoft. And joining me today, you know, the brains, is Kurt Kleijs from a senior .NET architect and trainer at Ordina. And we'll be working together through this session. Our role is a little bit like this. So he's the guy who does the stuff. He's the the Shrek of the whole story. And I'll be a little bit more donkey. like Donkey, you know, just trying to talk here and there and just creating a little bit of the story without actually doing much.
Right.
So that's a little bit the way we distributed our roles. Now, to be very clear, the room is, you know, it's nice to see so many people here, but I want to chase already some people away. Now it's still early enough to go to another session. So I expect half of the session, or half of the people here to leave. This session is not for the professionals. It is not for those who are already working with the Entity Framework in the current version. We are really going to cover the basics, right? It's about the basics. It's about how you get started with the Entity Framework, what it does, what it doesn't do, at a very basic level. We won't even compare it much with the current version out there. So if that's what you're looking for, then please leave the room and find another session to attend. It's still early enough because I just want to set the right expectations here. So don't feel bad if you switch sessions right
so
now.
So this is my chance to leave now?
This is no. Okay, you need thanks. To stay. You're the only person that I actually want to stay over here. So our agenda. I'm going to start by creating a little bit of context where we come from and why are we talking about ORM at all. The second thing I'm going to be talking about is how and what we're going to be showing is how do you get started with the Entity Framework in the .NET Runtime 4.0. How do we get started? How do you create a model? How do you refine that model? How do you work with that entity model? So how do you do queries, etc.? In the second part of the talk, then, or in the third part already, we're going to talk about how do you optimize this model and how do you work, for instance, with the Entity Framework in a distributed environment. We're going to touch very briefly on some considerations and limitations, for instance, when you work in a multi-tier environment. And we thought it would be a great idea to end with a conclusion. So we're going to have a conclusion for this talk as well. And then we'll give you some chances to ask some questions, and hopefully we'll give you some answers. But first, where do we come from? You know, when I went, when I was still going to school and the animals could still talk, at that point, it was actually this gentleman who taught us how to deal with databases. Who knows who this is? Who is it? God? Yeah, who said that over there? Somebody who shouted it? Yeah. I'll give you can collect a book over here just for answering that question. This was indeed Dr. Cott, and not Dr. Entity Framework Cott, it was Edgar Frank Cott that his full name was. This guy really taught us how to deal with data. This guy taught us that we had to normalize it in a number of steps so that we ended up with tables with relationship between that. And starting from those tables, you know, we started adding a lot of stuff. We first of all, we started to create queries, and not just a select from, where, order by, but also the query languages as such, they evolved, and we added more and more real coding paradigms to languages like the SQL language. Now, not only did we create a more complex querying languages, We also, in the database itself, started adding a number of constructs. We started, of course, you can add indexes. You can also code in stored procedures. You can create views for security reasons or for abstraction reasons. And you can even work with things like triggers, which work completely within the database and allow you to add code over there. So we've been making the database side of things more and more and more complex, if you like, but also sometimes more secure, more performant. So that's also the benefit of doing all of these types of things. At the same time, we've created languages. We had a lot of different versions. We had RDO, we had DAO, we had ADO, and we created these ways to access data. And very often what you see is that there is no clear separation between your tables and between your database schema and between the way that you access data in your code, because you still see the select statements, the update statements, the parameters, etc., that you need to pass on to a stored procedure. You see those reflected very clearly in your code. And obviously, you create dependencies. You create dependencies between your code and between your database schema and between your database logic. And that is hard to deal with, ultimately. This is obviously a very simple schema from the Northwind database, but think about an SAP database, for instance, where you have, for the ERP system, you have over 30,000 tables. You know, if you then start really hard coding a lot of stuff on your coding side, on your application side, you're going to eventually run into a series of issues. That's why some people said enough. We need something else. We need ORM. We need object relational mapping, a technique to work with relational tables as if they were objects in memory. So on the database side, you work with tables. On your coding side, on your application side, you work with objects, as you do for regular, plain, simple objects. That sort of separation was actually the goal of ORM. So the intention is to hide away the complexity of the underlying database, of the underlying tables, and to give a uniform way to working with data. You work with data as if that data is just a collection of regular objects that you work with in your code. The advantages: developer productivity, retain database independence. So it means that if you make a change, for instance, in your database, if you change a table name, to give a very simple example, that shouldn't per se affect your code. You shouldn't have to rebuild, recompile your code just because you changed a name in your database. So that abstraction layer actually gives you that independence. And you can also use your ADO.NET Entity Framework system, your ORM system, for instance, to work on databases from multiple vendors. So you can build your code so that it works on Microsoft SQL Server or on Oracle or on MySQL, for instance, or on databases from other vendors. That's also one of these goals from ORM. So we had many attempts at Microsoft at creating an ORM, an object relational mapping layer. Typed data sets could be considered as one of these attempts to at least make your data accessible as objects. You know, we shipped that. Some people probably used it. Some people probably hated it. That's very well possible with this one. We had object spaces. It had a code name called KeyOps, version 1 and version 2. And even though it had two versions, it was never shipped. So that's very peculiar, actually. We had the Microsoft Business Framework, Project Green, not well known, also an ORM type of system. We had the Windows file system when we, at the time, started talking about Windows Longhorn, which ultimately turned out to be Vista. After a while, we talked about WinFS, the Windows file system. That was an ORM layer that mapped data constructs really into objects. So we had that. And then we had Link to SQL. And so WinFS never shipped, by the way. Then we had Link2SQL. Link2SQL shipped and is being used by people today. And we also have ADO.NET Entity Framework, which is now a V2 released with .NET Framework 4.0 on April the 12th. And it's really a Microsoft strategic technology. So we use it also in other of our some of our own products as well, which is always a good sign. Like, is this a technology that Microsoft is really betting on, or is this just a technology that Microsoft is throwing out there to try? This one is really our strategic technology. Some of you might think Link2SQL, isn't that still around? Some of you might even say, you know, Link2SQL is dead. Now, Microsoft will never say Link2SQL is dead. Kurt, would you say Link2SQL is dead?
Well, I talked to some people and they say it is less evolving. It's not, there's less evolution into the product. And of course, Entity Framework is their main strategy product. So this will evolve more in the future, and an Entity Framework will be kept alive like it is, with little to no evolution, of course.
Okay, so even Kurt says it isn't really dead, but Kurt starts to sound a lot like a Microsoft person right now. But anyway, so it's up to you. And if you look at what is the ORM model from Microsoft that is going to evolve over the next few years, it's clearly the Entity Framework. So let's get started with that. So most of this session is actually demos where we're going to show you how you can work with the model, how you can fine-tune it, etc. And in this first demo, Kurt is going to talk to you how you can create a domain, how you can tune the model, and how you can do create, read, update, and delete statements against the model. Kurt?
Okay. So first demo is just how to create your model and how to generate the structure of your database. So now Visual Studio 2010 supports an approach that says, well, you just define your model and then you create all your tables. And meanwhile, your model is also updated with all the mapping constructions that are needed to talk to that database. So the way to do that is simply add an item. And that item is, of course, called an entity data model, just model one. Good enough. And now I have the decision whether to go from the database or whether to start with an empty model. So I start with this empty model and click finish. So then the designer opens up and I have a toolbox to create some classes. Well, it's not really classes, they are called entities. So I will place an entity on the designer. It's over here. And I will call this entity, let's say, speaker. And I will add another entity, like session. Speaker also has a name, which is a scalar property. And a session has a title. So I'm creating my entities, but I now also want to create associations between entities. Like in this situation, we have two speakers for one session, so this means we have a multi-to-multi relationship between speaker and session. So a relationship is also done by adding something from the toolbox. I will add an association from speaker to session. And by default, he's thinking I'm creating a one-to-many relationship, so I have to change this. Instead of one to star, I'm just going to the properties and I will say, well, there is also a collection of speakers. So this means speaker and session, so I have a multi-to-multi relationship. Another relationship is, for instance, like a session can be part of a track. I will create another entity which is called track and create an association. Having some trouble here with the resolution, but no problem, I will manage. From session to track. And then I have created all my entities. Next thing I do is just save it and ask to Visual Studio, can you please generate me the database from the model? And he's asking me to provide me a connection string, and this will be the empty database. I created already an empty database, which has no tables. And I click Next. And what he does is, he's investigating the model, and he's creating a SQL script. And that SQL script, it's not executed yet. You have to copy-paste it and go to your Visual Studio management and then execute that SQL script. So here I find my create table, I find my session set, I find my track set, and I also have this table here, very interesting. I have created a multi-to-multi relationship, so this means in a database I have to create a table which is containing the two primary keys of the two relations. So here you see speaker ID and session ID are part of that table. So I will just copy-paste this and run it from within Management Studio. I go to my empty database, create a new query here, and execute this. So all my tables are created. Let's have a look at the database diagram. It's in empty DB. So here you see all my tables are created. So he has created some script, but he also has created some information inside the model. So if I open up the model here, which is an EDMX file, if I open this with an XML designer, I can see the three different parts of my model. I have a storage layer, I have a conceptual layer, which are my entities, and I have some mapping in between. And if I look at the storage model, well, all the information is here. The speaker has an ID, in32 has a string, all the information is over here. So he's created the script, he has updated the model, and you're ready to use that. This is the domain-driven approach. You first create a domain, and then you create your database. Yes. So what about the other way of working? I'm going to say no here. Other way of working is you start with your database. Let's go back to my database again. I can close this diagram here. And let's have a look at this table here. This table is called TBL beverages. Nobody knows what it means, but this is a table that contains beverages, drinks like beer, like Coke, and so on. Let's have a look at the record that is inside this. I have two records, and I have some fields. I have a product name, Cola, Jupiler. I have some price. I have a sugar content for Cola, and I have an alcohol percentage for Jupiler. So this means in this record I have two types of, let's call it, entities. And the difference is the soda has this letter S as part of the type, and B for beers. And if we're talking about beer, we're not interested in the sugar content. And if we're talking about a soda, we're not interested in the alcohol percentage. So this is a typical design pattern somewhere in our databases. How can we work with this in our model? Well, I will create a new application here. I already prepared something. I will create a new model, add new item, entity data model, and now I select generate from database. So I click next, and he's asking me what database. I select the database, I say next, and now he's reading all the tables in my database, and the table that I'm interested in using is tuple.beverage, you know, and as I finish. So now he's inserting one entity into my model. But of course, now I want to fine-tune this model. I'm not happy with this very simple approach. First of all, I want to rename this entity. And instead of this ugly name that I have in my database, my developers want to use not this weird name, but they want to use beverages. That's one thing. Next is also the names of the fields. I want to rename them because I want to have a clean model, not with that weird syntax here. So product name will be just name, sugar content will be sugar content, and alcohol P will be alcohol percentage. All right. That's one thing. Next step is, well, I'm an object-oriented developer. I want to work with subclasses of beverages. So I want to create entities, one for beers and one for sodas, which are subclasses of the beverages entity. So I'll add an entity which I call beer, and I select my base type. Base type is beverages. I create another one, soda, and the base type is, of course, also beverages. Okay. Now, next thing is, well, sodas, they only contain ID, name, price, and sugar content. So I can move this. I can say I'm going to cut this and paste it over here. And also for my alcohol percentage, I'm doing the same thing. So now my class beers has the alcohol percentage, but not the sugar content field. Next step is I do have to do some table mapping again. We're doing mapping. Entities are mapped to tables. So this subclass, which is called beer, is now mapped to, again, to my table. And in that table, there are two fields which are not mapped yet. All the other fields are already mapped at a higher level at my parent. So here, sugar content, well, I'm not interested in this. Alcohol P will be mapped to alcohol percentage. And the next thing I have to do is specify a condition. I'm creating some information into the model that is specifying that if you want to talk to a beer, if you want to work with the entity beer, in the database, this will be stored as a record in the beverages table with the type field set to the character B. That's what I'm specifying here. So the beverages is a beer when the type is equal to B. And I do exactly the same thing for sodas. Table mapping. It's also coming from the beverages table, and now I map my sugar content. And here I specify type equals S. Almost finished. One thing, I have to delete the type field from my beverages because the type field is not interesting anymore. I know the difference between a beer and a soda because it is based on another class. So the type field, well, I just simply can delete that type field from my database, from my model. So let's try to build it. And just one little error, I think, which is not bad. It's price with capitals. I haven't changed it. That was the problem. So now let's run some code. First, have a look at how to query that table. I'm just opening my context and creating a query. And I got some beverages out of that query. And I can select, well, is this item, which is coming from my beverages entity, is this a beer or this is a soda? If so, I can cast it to the correct type. But let's have a look at some more code. I can use this operator here on my link query, very important. I can specify, get me some information from the beverages entity, only if it is of type beer. So this will result in my query having an additional field in my where clause, specifying that the type should be the constant B. So if I run this application.
So Kurt, when you create that context, what happens? Is it just a connection to the database, or does he instantiate the whole model, or what?
He's reading that model. He knows all the information from the model, but he's not opening a connection to the database. He's not doing anything with the database. You're only talking to the database when you execute a query. So if you create a link query, very important to understand, if you just have one line of code, which is your link query, nothing happens. You only execute that query, and the entity framework will translate your query to a Transact SQL version of that query, and it will be only be executed when you do some operation on that query, and when you bind it to a data grid, or when you do a for each on all those records, then you go to the database. That's the idea about.
And when the context is created, does he have to read those XML files over and over again, or is that compiled as well?
No, he's doing some caching. He doesn't read it over and over again. He's reading all the information. So the EDMX file, which is my model, is separated into three different files: the conceptual storage, the conceptual layer, the storage layer, and the mapping. And those metadata are really needed at runtime. You have to provide them together with the application. Two options to do that: you can embed that as a resource in your DLL or in your executable, or you can store them on a directory somewhere. And the files can be just XML files that you can store somewhere in a directory, and your application can use them. So going back to this beverages stuff, so I read the beverages. There is no beer. Must have made a mistake somewhere. When type B, you see. So I have my cola, my Jupiler. I can only read the beers, I can only read the sodas. What about inserting information? I'm going to show you the code for that. At Duvel, for instance, this code looks like this. Opening in the context and just instantiating a variable of the class beer. Beer is a class that is generated by my model. I give it some ID, I give it some name, I give it the alcohol percentage, I give it some price, but I don't specify B as being the type. I'm already said it that I'm working with beers. And then there is this method called addToBeverages, which is part of my context, and that context is generated by the model, which is accepting a beverage. And beer, because it is inheriting from beverages, is also a beverage. So I add this to my context, and then I do save changes. Those save changes will result in an insert statement into the database, but it will need the information in the metadata model to do the correct insert. And he has to know that we have to insert that record with B or S in the type field. So simply running this at Duvel and then reading the beverages, my Duvel is there.
Can you show some of that SQL?
I'm going to start the profiler for that. Starting a new trace, connecting. Okay, clear this, so I will start the application again. Going to first delete it, read beverages, add Duvel, read. Okay, so now my profiler has some information. Here you see, for instance, well, I see part of a query where he's working with the type. I will also see my insert.
Somewhere.
Yeah, the insert should be somewhere here. Let's clear it again.
Yeah. But finally, some SQL. This gives me the opportunity. Kurt, do you know that joke about that SQL query? No?
I know he's good at telling jokes, but that's the one I don't know.
Oh, okay, so there's a SQL query that walks into a bar. It's quite busy, and the query stands in front of two tables and asks, "Can I join you?" No? Okay, that's the last joke.
Don't try this
at
home, kids. Don't tell that joke to your wife or to your children.
Okay, that's the last one.
Only as a geek you understand. So, that was the demo.
You didn't show the insert, but in a trace.
Oh, right. So, let's start it again. I'm reading it. My Duvel is not there, so I'm doing the delete of the Duvel, add the Duvel, but...
And now you should have it.
Now I should have it somewhere. I'm working with a small resolution here, so...
Yeah, that's a pain. Is that one probably, yeah?
Here is the insert, so that should be the one.
Yeah.
Here you see.
There's the insert statement.
The letter B is part of my model, and he knows how to insert into the database. That's the idea about entity framework or ORM in general. Okay.
Now, before we leave this demo, because I think you're almost complete with this one.
Yes, I'm complete.
My connection string, is that still in the same place, or is it...
That connection string is like usual in your appconfig file, and that's a very special connection string. So we're going to open this appconfig file over here. Have a look at that connection string. That connection string has some weird syntax. It has some references to the three files that are generated out of my ADMX model, CSDL file, SSDL file, and my mapping file. And it contains a reference to the provider, SQL client. And it contains the classic connection string, which has a data source and an initial catalog. So it's not a normal connection string. It's a connection string which is embedded inside an entity connection string. And that entity connection string has some information where to find the metadata to do the mapping. So it's still in the same place, only the structure is different.
Okay. Right, so in these first two demos, you actually saw how you can create the domain model starting just from the object side of things, or how you can actually build your model based on an existing database. Is one approach preferred over the other, or are both equally well?
They're both equally well. I think it depends on your own situation. If you can start from scratch and you don't have a database, maybe it's a good approach to do the domain-driven approach. Start with your model and then generate your tables. But on the other hand, if you have a database team which has already created their database, well, then you have to use the insert into the model. You have to create your model on top of your database. It depends on your situation, I think.
Okay.
But important to know is both approaches are possible. That's the fine thing about entity framework.
Okay, thanks. So what about performance and security? This is always a big concern, and I'm sure for a lot of you who have been writing some data access code, you're always thinking about what's the relationship between the number of connections I open and the amount of data that I retrieve every time. Do I try to read as much data at one time as possible, or do I create a more chatty interface where I just get just the bits of data that I need? That's always something that you need to think about and need to be aware of. And to a certain extent, you'll also need to be aware of that paradigm or that dilemma a little bit over here. But the good news is, and we'll show you that in a demo as well, that when you work with an ORM, you still have flexibility. You still have ways to optimize your data access. For instance, by using stored procedures. If there are things you do better via stored procedures for security reasons or for performance reasons, you can still do that. If you want to create views for abstraction reasons, security reasons, etc., you can still do that. And you can actually configure how the entity framework, the ADO.NET entity framework, actually loads your data. There are a couple of models here. There is eager loading. This basically means that, and Kurt will show you that in a demo, that let's say that I have an object customers, and customers have orders. Eager loading would mean that I can specify that when I load the customer, I automatically, at the same time as the connection is open, I automatically load all of the orders for that customer in one go. Lazy loading means that I just get the orders for a customer as I read them, as I need them. Not immediately, but as I need them. But lazy also means automatically. You don't need to do much as a developer. And then there's actually a third option which isn't used that much. It's explicit loading. This means that it's not loaded automatically. The orders are not loaded automatically with the customer. But instead of just fetching them as you need them, you will still need to call a load method explicitly before the data is actually being captured, retrieved from the database. But that third option, I put it kind of between brackets because there's quite a bit of discussion about that also on blogs, for instance, where they say, if you really know how and where to put your code, and if you're using lazy loading where you're supposed to use it, then there's no way that you can do it better than that, and that you need the explicit methods anymore. Just, you know, design your code properly, and there will be no more need or not much need anymore for explicit loading. With that, I think we're going to jump into a second set of demos where we show how you can use views, stored procedures, and how you can actually work with this eager and deferred or eager and lazy loading.
Okay. So going back to my demo database, I have a table here which is called visitor stats. Very simple table. It has some two fields. And actually, I don't want to use that table directly into my model. I created a view on top of that table, and there are good reasons to create a view. And maybe you want to aggregate some information from multiple tables, or maybe you want to add some security border by using that view. So views are very much used and also supported by Entity Framework and Visual Studio, of course. Besides that, my views, I also have some stored procedures. I typically create stored procedures to do the CRUD operation, one for delete, one for update, one for insert, and so on. And I have some other stored procedures just to collect the select of my view, or maybe based on a primary key, I have a stored procedure which is taking an argument as a primary key, and I get that information back to the client, of course. So let's have a look at the view. The view here, just doing the design, it's this one here, just a select visitor stats, visitor feedback data from dbo.visitor stats. Let's have a look at my stored procedure. I'm going to show you the insert one. Just a stored procedure which takes some information as a varchar and inserts the information into that table. And especially for this demo, to show you that we are working with a stored procedure, I added something. I'm not only inserting that field into my table, I will add from Antwerp. And just to show you that I'm going through my stored procedures. So the model, I already created that model. It is just the same way of working. You can add also a view to the model. And he knows all the fields of that view. And the model or the entity is also mapped to my view. So if I go to table mapping here on my visitor stats, I see, well, the entity visitor stats is mapped to my view visitor stats. And again, all the fields which are part of my view are now mapped to one of the fields in my entity. So very simple. But what about the other way around? If I want to do insert, updates, and deletes, and you know we cannot do that on a view, or normally we shouldn't do that on a view.
You can't do that if a view spans more than one table? Or
that will be very difficult. That will be very difficult. So now we get rid of this difficulty. We just create a model with some entities. Instead of going to the mapping details for the columns, I can go to the mapping details for the stored procedures. There is a place for every CRUD operation, insert, update, and delete, where I specify stored procedures. So the way how to do that, I will just create, and to really show you how this works, I will create a new item, also an entity data model, and I will generate it from the database, which is my TechDays database. Next. Tables, well, I don't want a table, I want a view, and I want the stored procedures. Update, and so on. These are the ones that I need. And I say finish. So the wizard is capable of understanding all the views and all these stored procedures inside my database and can use that for fine-tuning my model. So here I can go to this entity, go to the table mapping, go to the mapping details for the functions, and here I can select. Here they are. Little problem with the resolution, sorry. You see all the stored procedures appearing, and if you select one here for the delete, I can map that also to some places in my model, in my entity. That's the way to work with stored procedures. I'm not going to use this here. Just going to run that demo, and this model can be deleted, of course, just for demo purposes. Let's try to build. Going to show you some code to do that. Well, the code is really the same as the previous code. You're working with a model. You don't know that you're using stored procedures or views. You're working with your model. Again, I'm specifying a context. I'm creating a query, and now I'm for reaching through that query, and he will read that from the view. If I run this, he will read some information from the view because this is my data inside my database foo and bar. How to insert some records. Again, we have this method based on my context, add to visitor stats, and I need to create there a new object, a visitor stats object, with the information. I specify here hello. So the word hello is given to the stored procedure, and the stored procedure is inserting that into the database. So let's run this, add, read, and I get hello from Antwerp. And hello was coming from my application, and from Antwerp is the thing that my stored procedure has done. And I can also do delete again. So it's gone. It's another one which is gone, and so on. I can also do updates. So I'm calling the update store procedure, but I don't know that. I'm just doing this. This is the typical way to do an update on your tables by using entity framework. You specify your context again. You specify a query. You read some information from the database by doing the dot first operation. And then you change one field. And then your object context knows that you have changed that field. And it does do, and now you're asking the save changes. And based on your model, you're either doing a dynamic update on your database, if it is not coupled to a stored procedure. But in this situation, it is coupled to a stored procedure. So he knows he has to provide the information to the stored procedure and then continue to the database. Yes. So that's the way how to work with stored procedures and with views. You have very much places where you can use all those stored procedures. Yeah?
So correct me if I'm wrong, but it feels like if you just work directly with tables without stored procedures and views, you know, the entity framework takes care of all the hocus pocus and there's all the translation.
Yep.
Here there's a little bit more configuration, but it still stays in that layer in between your real code and between your database. So you still have that same abstraction. So once you change something in your stored procedure, for instance, rename a parameter, you only need to update your model, not your code. You need to remap the model in something in the model and not in the
To show you that, I got your point. To show you that, I'm going to show you that EDMX file again. And in the EDMX file, you see a select based on my view as a query to define my input. And also I see here the names of my stored procedures and the parameters. That's the only thing that the model knows. He knows the names of the stored procedures and he knows the parameters. So what I do inside my stored procedure, well, the entity framework doesn't care. And you can change your query hints, for instance. You can create a stored procedure with some complicated query. Maybe you can optimize that, and that's the responsibility of your database administrator, for instance, while it doesn't influence your application. Your application is talking to the objects. The objects know for an insert, update, and delete, I have to talk to the stored procedure, but you can change that stored procedure. You can be totally independent of the evolution of your database. And if the database administrator wants to change something, he can do that without you having to recompile and rebuild your application. Yes. So that was about stored procedures. Next demo is about querying. Hans said it, there are different options to do queries. You have lazy, you have eager, you have some implicit and explicit options. I will show you that in a demo. And that demo is based on a parent-child relation in my database. Database here, over here. I'm going to close this. I'm going back to the Object Explorer. I have this table. Where are you? I have two tables, or I have many tables, of course. I have a table continent, and I have a table country, and I have a table city, and I have a table river. So my continent contains multiple countries, and countries contain multiple cities. And I also have this weird thing which is called a river. And a river is not part of a country. A river is part of a continent. And so I have relations in many directions. I just inserted that into Visual Studio. And the model looks like this. I call this model geography. And this is the model. Continent, country, city, and river on the other side. What you also see in this model that we have in Entity Framework, navigation properties. Navigation properties are actually kind of collection to the childs of that entity. For here, my continent has a navigation property called country, which is going to country, but it also has a navigation property river, which is going to river. And the same for country, going to city, and so on. But also the opposite direction. There is a navigation property from country back to continent. So if you have a country somewhere in your application and you read it from the database, it is very easy to access the information which is in the parent, which is on the continent. So very useful navigation properties, multi-to-multi, one-to-many, and so on. You can use that, very useful. I'm not going to save this because I haven't changed anything. Have a look at the code. I will show you the two different approaches. Let's start with eager loading. This is my query. This query is doing some eager loading, but not all of them. What I specified here in this query is, well, this query is based on my entity's context. Context.continent, that's the entity I want to query. But I specify this, .include country.city. Very important to see this here. And country.city are actually those navigation properties. If you change them in your model, you also need to change them, of course, in your code. So it's good to really think advanced of that name of that navigation property. So what this means is, well, if you read a continent, sorry, you also need to read the countries and the cities. But the framework, the entity framework, will do that very intelligent. He will create a select statement with some joins to the other tables. He will load everything before starting the for each loops. I'm going to start also the profiler here. I'm going to close this. Yes, and start a new trace. Declare it. And push the button, eager loading. So I have Europe, has country Belgium, has city Brussels, Antwerp, Ghent, Netherlands, Amsterdam, and so on. And also has the river Danube, the Donau. So what happened in my profiler? He's done one select statement based on my continent joined with my countries. So country ID is joined on my continent. And he executed that. And this join results in the continents and the countries as one batch coming from my database. But for my rivers, for every continent, he has executed a separate query to my database. So here I see a query on river for the continent one, and also one for the continent two, and also one for the continent three. So I'm using partial eager loading. I loaded my countries and my cities in one movement, and for every iteration in my continent, I go back to the database to load up a river. I'm going to show you the code, and I will change that. So you see the difference here. I have a for each, a for each, a for each, and another for each for my river. And this is the code that is populating my text box. So the difference with I do this, I will add an include statement here. And that include statement is also containing river. Going to stop my profiler and clear it. Run the application again. Of course, the result will be exactly the same. My river Danube is here. Yeah. But if I look to the query, I haven't started it, so I do it again. Yeah. He sees there is one select statement, and there is no extra select statement to get the rivers for every iteration in my continent. So he's now doing a very complex join. He's joining also on river. So I have the opportunity as a developer to specify what I want to load of my object graph, my continent, my country, my city, also my river, and so on. I can do this by design. I can do that based on the include statement that Entity Framework is offering for us. So this is the eager loading one. Let's have a look at lazy loading. Lazy loading here is exactly the same code for my for eaches. I just iterate to all my information inside my continent based on that navigation properties. And I specify nothing on my query. My query only simply says, well, I want continents. Nothing more than that. And if I run it, I will go to the database for every continent, for every country, for every city, and so on. So it is already running, starting up. I have the same information, but what happens? I see no information. I only see Europe, Asia, and Africa. What I've done here is, I set lazy enabled to false. And this is not the default. The default is true. So if I do it like the default, I get all my information again. So this is lazy loading. He's doing a select on the database for every iteration in the parent. He's not doing a join statement before. He's just selecting country, or he's just selecting a continent. And for every continent, he's going back to the database. So if my profiler would still be running, I will do that again. You will see a lot of select statements. And you see all the select statements appearing over here. So this is the lazy approach. And this is the approach that also Link2 SQL is using. And this is also the approach that other ORM tools around are using. But here in Entity Framework, you have the option to change the default. If I say loading enabled is false, yes. If I say lazy loading enabled is false, I end up with an empty collection. Okay, my continents are there, but it looks like there are no countries inside that continent. So then I have to use the explicit way of working. I have to specify, based on my iteration variable here, before I start my for each in my continent, continent.country.load, because country was my navigation property, which is part of my model. And now I explicitly say, all right, you need to load the information. And so if I run this, I get Europe has some countries, Belgium, Netherlands, France. So this gives me the opportunity as a developer to specify very exactly where I want to load the information and not do it lazy and not doing it automatically by the framework. So you have many, many options to do the querying. Yeah.
Well, I just have one question. I'm seeing that in every method that you created for the demo, you again and again create that entity context. Is that a good practice, or is that just for demo purposes?
Well, for demo purposes, this is very useful. In real life, you have to work with some pattern which is called the unit of work pattern. Unit of work is you want to insert a lot of things in the database. From within your design, you have to create some combination of actions as a unit of work. And in the beginning of that unit of work, you start your context. And at the end of the unit of work, you say, well, context, save changes, and everything that has been changed, it will be updated to the database again. So the idea is not to have your object context placed in a global variable. Open your object context whenever you need it as part of the unit of work pattern. Do your thing, and then close your object context again.
But also, it's not so that when I open my object context, that automatically, already at that point, the connection to the database is open. That's not the case, I think.
No, I don't know. You're not opening the database.
You're not
connection.
Opening the
database.
No. Okay. No. Okay. Good. Okay. That was our second set of demos, working with views, stored procedures, your querying options, eager versus deferred, but that's the same as lazy loading. And you even showed explicit loading. But again, some people would argue that explicit loading option isn't all that useful if you correctly place your code and if you correctly write it. Then, as a final important point, I think there are some really interesting considerations to make when you build an application that is a multi-tiered application. And frankly, you know, even 10 years ago, when we were still talking about Microsoft DNA, we were already telling people to build applications in multiple tiers to separate your UI from your middle tier, from your database layer. And so I can imagine that most of you, and I hope actually that most of you, are actually building a multi-tiered application. But then the question that everybody will have, Kurt, also, is how do you pass on objects from one tier to the next. So in your middle tier or in your data layer, you collect these objects, these collections of objects. Mm-hmm. Can you just pass them on? Or do you pass on your, maybe even your entity context? What do you do? And what if once you get your information in your client application and you make some modifications, I'm adding a customer, I'm making a change to an order, and I want to pass back those modifications through the same layer all the way back to the database. Mm-hmm. How does that work?
I will show you a demo on that, but just to give some background information on this diagram here, the client has no object context, and that's the basic idea about distributed applications. Your object context is going to your database, so it needs access to your database. The client, which can be maybe a Silverlight client, in the future Windows 7 client, and so on. There is no object context over there. And on the other hand, we want to create WCF services, which can talk to the database, and for every operation, either the get operation or the update of the operation, you're going to open that context, do your thing, and then close the context after you do the save changes. So I open the context in the get, I open the context also in the update, but very important to understand, an object context is not serializable. And this means I cannot send the object context from server to client. There is no way that the client can use that object context. So we need another way of working, and that other way of working is supported in Visual Studio. I support it in Entity Framework, and the thing is called self-tracking entities. And self-tracking entities are entities which are not inheriting from the standard entity object, and they are just classes which are implementing some interfaces. And self-tracking entities can also be generated from the same model that you start working with, and it's just another template that you're using for generating the classes. Going to switch to my machine, I will show you that in a demo. Okay. I have this application or this solution where I typically have a client, I have a separate library for the domain, I have a service which is a WCF service, and I have some service contracts. Let's start like a good developer, like a good service-oriented designer. I will start with the interface, and those interfaces are service contract, operation contracts, the stuff we use if we're using WCF. That technology is still available, of course. And I get two methods here, the get invoice and the update invoice. So I'm working on a database with an invoice table and invoice lines. Very typical scenario. So I have a get invoice and an update invoice, and they are working with that domain. Here, invoice, and here, invoice is part of my domain. Let me show you how I created this code. In my domain, I placed my EDMX file. I created my model, and I inserted some entities. Again, I see the navigation properties from invoice to invoice line and the way back. But what I've done is I said to Visual Studio, instead of creating the normal classes, you need not to create classes because I want to create my own classes based on that entity model. So here the custom tool is empty, and I need to add some template. I can add a code generation item. So this is a very nice point of Entity Framework. There are many, many extensibility points and very many points where you can customize how the behavior is of the generation of the code. And you can do that with T4 templates. And some T4 templates are already supported, are already inside Visual Studio. And one of the templates is you have the ADA.NET self-tracking entities template. And this means you're working with the same model, but the classes, the C-sharp classes or the VB.NET classes that are coming out of that model, are different. You can either work with the POCO approach, the plain old CLR object, so the objects don't have any reference to all other libraries or they don't inherit from some things. Here the self-tracking entities template will create a kind of POCO, but it will have some interfaces implemented. Just add this TT file, and after you do that, you get some more code that is generated for you. So here I have my invoice and my invoice lines. And you see a class, and very useful on that class, that template has already placed the attribute data contract, our beloved WCF data contract to go to work with distributed environments. And you see my invoice, my invoice lines. Where is my invoice? I'm first going to show you the invoice itself. It's a data contract. It has a known type, meaning there are some other types involved to create the XSD schemas and so on. And you see it's not inheriting from something. It is just implementing the I object with change tracker and the I notify property changed interface. Well, those interfaces are very useful to be used at the client. If we're doing data binding on the client, the data binding system will know that, well, you're binding to an object which is supporting those interfaces. The data binding context, the binding source, will use that methods inside the two interfaces to notify that the change has happened. Well, the system knows what has changed and remembers what you have deleted and knows the difference between inserts and updates and so on. So it's just a different approach of generating code. You have to use that self-tracking entity template. But at the end, it is just classes. And you can reference those classes like you've seen here in your operations. It can be the input out of your operations. It can be the input as a parameter to your service operation. So what about the implementation here? In my service implementation, I have very little code. I'm here working with that typical unit of work pattern, and I'm using a using statement to update or to instantiate my domain context. Using statement very useful. At the end of my scope here, there will be an automatically disposing of that context and so on. So here, my get invoice gets an ID, and I select this query, I execute this query. And here again, you typically say, I want to include my childs. The client is asking for an invoice. Well, here I want to say, well, you know, you need also the invoice lines. You do the include of the navigation property invoice lines. You go to the first one, and then you say this. And this is one line of code you have to add to that unit of work on your services. You enable the change tracking. You say to your object and the binding context on the client also knows, well, there is change tracking involved. I need to do that change tracking. When I send that invoice back to the server, it has to be updated again. And updating that to the server is doing this. One line of code. I get the invoice coming in. I'm opening my domain context. And I do context.invoice.applyChanges. And then I do the save changes. Then he knows there have to be some inserts that have to be done, maybe some updates, maybe I have to do delete because the invoice has changed. I do the apply changes, I do the save changes. The entity framework will do insert, update, and deletes on your database. Yes. What about my query? What about my client? So my client here has also a reference to my domain. Of course, it doesn't have any reference to my services, but it has a reference to my domain. So it also has those classes. It doesn't need the ADMX file. Here, if I look back to my domain, maybe it would be better to also have my ADMX file placed in another library than my generated classes. So I don't need the ADMX file on the client. And the client doesn't know any reference to the ADMX file. He only needs references to those classes which are here. And so in a good design, from an architectural point of view, you would specify another library for your ADMX file and yet another library for your data contracts and the entity contracts which are becoming data contracts. Then going to my user interface, I simply have a form, and that form is very basic. I have a calendar control, I have a data grid control, and the way that I created this form is by doing show data sources, and I see my domain. Just because I reference my domain, and that domain has some classes which are supporting some interfaces, they show up in the data sources view, and I see my invoice, and I can drag and drop them to my user interface. Yes? What also I have here is my proxy. Of course, there is a proxy involved. When every distributed application using WCF, there is some way, there is somewhere a proxy involved. That proxy can be generated by doing add service reference, but it can also be coded by hand here. My proxy is just a class which is inheriting from my client base, has a reference to some endpoint, and that endpoint is placed in my app config. So my service is running on localhost and so on and so on. And that proxy is just channeling that information through to my service and get the invoice and update invoice. In the user interface, I'm instantiating the proxy in a button somewhere. We'll show you that. First of all, here I see that my invoice here is scoped at the form level. It's not inside one of those buttons, one of those functions. I'm in the user interface, so I can remain state somewhere on my user interface. So I have this invoice somewhere at the global level in my application. So then I have the button one click, which is instantiating the proxy and getting the invoice number one. And two lines of code to bind this to my user interface. So here again, the invoice which is coming out of this is part of my domain. It is inside my domain library. It's the same class. It is also a data contract, of course. So binding that invoice and also the invoice lines to my user interface is very simple. So now my user can work with it. It can change some information on the screen. And then I have this other button to do the update invoice. And I just pick the invoice which is globally scoped on my form, and I give it to my proxy, and my proxy is giving it to my service, and my service is opening the object context. He's doing an apply changes of the incoming invoice, and entity framework will do some insert update and deletes to my database. Yeah. To show you that, just running this application, just try to run it. So my service is here starting. It is just a console self-hosted WCF service in Visual Studio. And I have my client, and I do the get invoice. Service knows, well, get invoice, I do what you ask for, and I get this information. I can change now some the invoice date. I can change the quantity, let's say 100 of this, 500 of this. And I will also add some invoice line, maybe this one, and so on. So I can now work as an end user. I can work with the data which is bound to my user interface. And the next thing I do is just do an update invoice. And he's sending that invoice, which has the change tracking enabled flag set to true. He's sending that invoice back to my WCF service. And everything is updated again. So if I do the get invoice again, I get that same information. Yeah. So main thing you have to remember about this demo is creating code from your model can be done in several ways. You have your model and your C# classes are generated out of that model. By default, the classes that are coming out of that are not really useful in a multi-tier approach because they are inheriting from entity object. And you don't want to have entity object on your client. So you have to use another strategy, another way of creating your code. And that you can do that with a self-tracking entity template. And that template can also be downloaded from the Microsoft site. You can configure that inside Visual Studio. So you're creating code, but in another approach. For every architecture, you will need some other template. That's the idea. Okay?
Just a couple of questions. As always with these loosely coupled systems, people can be updating the same record at the same time from multiple clients. And then somebody, the developer needs to write some conflict resolution codes, etc. Mm-hmm. Is this being dealt with automatically on your WCF layer? Or mm-hmm. is this something that a developer, is responsible for?
The developer has the opportunity to catch errors if concurrency errors are happening. And the way we are working is we're using optimistic concurrency. So this means we're using some fields, some flags, or some timestamps to check first or to change the update statement with the where clause to really see if that record was not changed by somebody else before I'm doing the update. And if such an error is happening, you get an exception. So you have to try catch your save changes. If you say objects context.save changes, there has to be some try catch around that. And if the save changes succeeds, no problem. But if there is some concurrency problem because the field is not the same as in your database anymore, you can catch that exception. And based on that exception, you can get a list of all the conflicting records. Maybe you inserted 100 records and only 50 or maybe one of them is causing a conflict. Well, in that exception, you can get to that one entity, and then you can decide what you do with that one entity. Either you can say, well, I want to force my update into the database, so the other guy loses these changes, or you can select, well, okay, I'm not going to force that update, and the other insert was there before, so he wins. So it's up to the developer to do some fine try catching to get the errors coming out of your optimistic concurrency model. Yeah?
Okay. One last question. The objects that you were using, you know, also on the client side, you've been using that now in a Windows Forms application. Mm-hmm. Is that available today already in Silverlight and as well, or do you know?
Well, the objects that are coming out of your self-tracking entity template generator are just C# classes, so you can use them in other clients also. Yeah, of course.
Okay, good, thank you. So this was our last demo, actually, where we showed you distributed entities, how to use a context, an entity context, basically, in the service layer, and how you can do data binding on the client. But obviously, on the client, you're not forced to use data binding. You can just manipulate, update, etc., through code as well. We just tried to show data binding because I was asking Kurt, yep, does it work with data binding, or do I really need data sets to use data binding? And then we were able to show you this. So with that, we have reached actually the part where we actually want to conclude this this talk. And I just want to very clearly say that ADO.NET Entity Framework is a strategic technology for Microsoft. I think it's important for you to understand that. Sometimes it's difficult to see on which technologies Microsoft is really betting or which technologies are just like spaghetti. They're throwing it against the wall and see if it sticks. So this one is a strategic technology. And in V2, the one that's being released with the .NET Framework 4.0, there's been a lot of modifications and enhancements to the Entity Framework. And a lot of that, you can still read that, is based on the feedback that customers have been giving to Microsoft. So that's also important to understand. Bottom line is, ORM decouples database from code and makes developers more productive. And we really believe that for the majority of your .NET applications, the ADO.NET Entity Framework is actually a good thing, and you should seriously consider it because of those productivity abstraction advantages that you get from using it. So with that, I want to conclude this session, but if there are any people who have any questions right now and want to shout them into the room, please do so. We're happy to answer them. Well, you're sitting quite far in the back, I can see you, but you can try.
You can apply changes, but it doesn't happen automatically. You can update your model back from your database. So if some changes are happening in your database and you have a new version of the database, you can have your original entity model and update it. You have to do it manually, and there is some update model from database wizard in Visual Studio, and you will see that some fields are updated, maybe some stored procedures are now available which weren't in the previous version, and then you can work with your modeling and your tuning again. It is possible, yes, but it doesn't happen automatically, of course.
Question
just
here?
Just a second, I'll pass the microphone.
Oh, okay, yeah, there's a question right here.
Who was it over there?
Okay.
Am I correct? If you want to delete some records with the Entity Framework, that you first have to select them? And
there are two options to do that. In normal conditions, you would say, yes, I need to select the record from my database inside the object context, inside the memory of my application, then execute a delete statement, an Entity Framework delete operation, and then do the save changes, and then you will notice, well, you have deleted something, I remembered the primary key, so I'm now doing a delete statement based on the primary key. Yeah? That's one option. Another option is a little trick. Well, it's a trick which is documented. You can just create a new object instead of reading it from your database. You can create it yourself in code, specify the primary key that you want to delete, then attach it to the content, to the context, and then ask, then do a delete, and then do the save changes. So it's like a little surrogate, like we're saying. You're not actually reading the information. You just simulate that you have read that information, but you do it in code by just creating a dummy object, which is your entity object, only specifying the primary key, and giving it the primary key, maybe in the constructor, and then attaching it to the object context, and then do a delete, a logical delete, and then do the save changes, and it will also do the delete. This works if you don't want to use concurrency, of course, and because you don't have all the original values of your record. And if you have a primary key which is containing multiple fields, of course you have to create and you have to insert multiple informations to that primary key. But it is possible in both directions, yeah.
Will it generate code for set-based updates or deletes? I mean SQL? Or is it just like link to SQL one by one?
You mean, will it create code for?
Well, for instance, I insert 10 objects into my collection and I do save changes.
Uh-huh.
Will it will it create 10 insert queries or if I?
Yeah,
can,
of course. To insert, you have to do 10 queries.
And if I change the same property for 10 objects,
it will do
10 updates.
It will do 10 updates. Okay. Yes. Huh? Even if you delete, if you like, for instance, you say you do a query on a table with 100 records, and then you do a for each, and in every iteration in the for each you do a delete, and then you do the save changes. The only thing that Entity Framework can do is, well, you deleted entities and he has remembered the primary key, so he's doing 100 deletes on your database, and also for updates and of course for inserts, yes. That's a typical way of working with ORM. He cannot be intelligent enough to do a delete with a where clause. That is not possible. No.
Question over there.
The distributed change tracking actually neglects one of the core tenets of service orientations, saying that services share schema, not
yep.
class.
That's totally true.
Do you actually want us to use this in a production environment, or is this just a demo of
No, I can. It's not just a demo. You're absolutely true about the pure SOA concept. You don't want to do that. But if you simply have a distributed application where there is no really service-oriented design behind it, why not use it? You can use it.
But you must admit I kind of forced you to create
that last demo
yeah. because yeah. your original reaction was, no, you typically don't do that in uh-huh. in a multi-tier application and yeah. you really want that separation and blah, blah, blah. Yeah. But I said, you know, but show me something that is a little bit more RAT, a little bit more rapid application mm-hmm. development.
This is the more
so
RAT
I did have to push him in that direction and it's mostly because I wanted yeah. to see it that you actually got yeah. to see this. Yeah. But obviously the part about basically tracking the changes in the object, that's still relevant whether or not you're actually mm. using the schema on both mm. sides. That's still very much an option also and relevant in an SOA context, but mm-hmm. I did have to force him to to build that demo.
And I volunteers.
Yeah.
One question over here, Hans.
Okay.
What do you do if you have an already existing data model? Can you create a mapping with it?
What do you mean with an existing data model?
If you already
model?
Have your own entities created, your own data classes, your own customer class, if you already have it created, mm. can you do the mapping with the database through
DORM? Yes, you can do. Again, you will select another template to generate the classes, and that template will be because you already have your code. Yeah. You can use the concept of like in POCUS, they're using the same context. Based on the name of your class and the name of your entity, that's already enough to do the match that this class is belonging to that entity. So you can do that. Yeah? So you will not generate any code. Your code is already existing. And you simply make sure that the names of your entities have the same name as the classes and the fields of your already existing model. That is possible, yes.
Okay, thank you. I think that's all of the questions that we're having.
I have one more over there.
Yeah, okay, one last, and then for the rest of the questions, you can actually come over here as well and ask them.
Hello. Does Entity Framework provide also easy functionality in the scenario where you have one entity's data spread over multiple tables?
Yeah, it has. There are some different patterns that are supported by Entity Framework. I don't know if you know the book Application Patterns, where Martin Fowler speaks of a lot of different ORM patterns, and one of the patterns are called TPH, table per hierarchy. The other one is called table per type. The other is called table per concrete class, and so on. So there are different patterns to map one table to multiple entities, or one entity to multiple tables, and so on. There are some different strategies or patterns to do that, and Entity Framework supports that. I've shown you one of those patterns. If you looked in the beverages demo, where I have one table, and actually in my code I'm working with the beer entity and with the soda entity, this is one of those mapping patterns, but there are other mapping patterns that are also supported by Entity Framework. Yeah.
Okay, thank you very much, and I hope you enjoy the rest of your conference. Thank you.